Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Here we go.
Here's John Williams.
This is John. How are you? You know, there's one side of me that goes, gee, it's chilly outside. I wish it was warmer, but in a month or so, we'll be thankful for a day like this. Sunshine, blue skies, 40s, downtown Chicago. Let's say the glass is half full, shall we? That's what we do on Fridays. We look on the bright side. I guess we should all carry around a little tote of that attitude with us 7 days a week, eh? The news click. At WGNradio.com, our daily web poll question yesterday was about the Bears coach, Matt Nagy. What should the Bears do with him? You had four options. You could say give him a raise, extend his contract. 3% said that, and they were just being silly. The second option, B, was keep him for now anyway. 45%, fire him as soon as possible, 43%, those people not having to pay out the rest of his five-year contract. And D was, I can't say it on the radio, that was 10%. So mostly we'll just have to grin and bear it for the time being with the Chicago Bears. That was the news click. We were going to make the question about that Buffalo Wild Wings incident in Naperville, but Elif and I couldn't put our finger on exactly the right wording of a question, particularly since there were a lot of details we didn't know. Since then, there was this remarkable press conference you've been hearing about on WGN Radio this morning, and some of the principals at that press conference are on a phone line right now. Cannon Lambert Sr. is an attorney representing the Vol family and the Buffalo Wild Wings case, and he is on a phone line. Cannon, it's John Williams. Welcome to WGN. How are you today?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm doing well, and I'm so grateful to be here with you. Thank you.
And I guess your client, Justin Vall, is also on a phone line, the father of one of those basketball players in the story, the husband of Mary Vall. Both of them spoke earlier today. And Justin, you're on WGN Radio also. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Gentlemen, I want to start with you, Justin, just to kind of walk us through, as my colleague said a moment ago, the TikTok of this thing. I got some of the answers to questions that we have maybe at the press conference, but perhaps you could help us a little bit. As we understand it, the team, 12 kids and six adults walk into the Buffalo Wild Wings. They're putting together tables. You all take a seat. Is that right?
So that is pretty accurate, but before we even take a seat, I was greeted by the host of the restaurant. And during my interaction with him, he asked me, before we were even seated, the host asked me what my race was.
I saw you on online today. You're fair-skinned for an African-American, but what was your response to that?
I'm multiple races, which really is no business to Buffalo Wild Wings.
Yeah,
obviously.
Right.
But my response was one. I was appalled. I felt disrespected, and disgusted that I would be asked that question. And then my response was, "Why does that matter?"
And so you're telling me that literally, as you all walked in, your race became an issue. It's not like you all had sat down and somebody said, "Oh, gee, there's that group of African Americans over there." Right away, they asked you that question.
No, we did. So we hadn't been sat down yet. The host went to go set up the table for us.
Yeah.
And as he's setting up the table, I went mentioned to him we needed a few more seats.
Right.
And I had walked over to him, and I walked back to the front where we were waiting, and that is when he came back up to me and said, he asked me what my race was, and then when I had asked him why that mattered, he said that we have a regular customer that is sitting near where we're going to set you up, and he is knowingly a racist.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want to sit around black people.
Okay, so this strikes me as being relatively early in your episode there. So when you heard that, he said, "Well, there's a racist over there." Literally, did he use the word racist?
Yes, he didn't say there's somebody like an angry customer or upset, he used the word racist. So that to me, that is pretty, and to say that it's a regular customer would mean to me that you would have to, they had to have experienced it before.
Yeah, they knew what they were talking about. Yeah.
They knew what they were talking about, and you knew that it was a regular. So you knowingly have this person here that's sitting here. It's not like he said that this is a angry customer or just somebody you don't want to sit around. He used the word racist, which is very definitive and very suggestive. So obviously, they knew, the restaurant knew, the host, the management team, they knew more about this customer than the average customer.
Right. And can you describe the manager? Was it a young person, an old person, black person, white person? The person you were having this conversation with, describe that person to me.
So the manager we didn't interact with, this was the host we were interacting with.
Okay, that person, yeah.
Asked the race. So he was a young black male. Yeah, he was a young black male. So to me, he was put in a position where he was trained or he felt like he needed to ask that, you know, being a young black male.
Well, so if they're set up then where they're going to now seat you near this guy, and he's already flagged this guy as a racist, I wonder what your thought or attitude was about taking a seat near that guy.
I mean, at the moment, you know, understandably, I don't know what to think. I've never been in this position before. Yeah. I'm disgusted I'm being asked this. I'm at a public establishment. We've visited Buffalo Wild Wings very frequently, multiple locations. So when they tell me that, I'm still thinking to myself, like, how do they know? Like, there's a lot of thoughts going through my head, but we were with a group of kids. So my number one thing is not thinking about myself. I'm thinking about my kids. I had two kids there at 10 and 5, and we had a bunch of kids with us. So they were hungry. They hadn't ate since lunchtime. So my biggest thing was we need to get these kids some food.
Yeah. So if we have to put up with this crazy guy in the corner, fine. We're just going to mind our own business over here, right?
Yeah, definitely. I'm like, you know, we're going to, you know, suck it up for a minute. And it wasn't in the corner. It was in the middle of the restaurant. So it's not like this guy that they are accommodating is sitting in an area where they're trying to separate him. He's literally in the middle of the restaurant. This is a family restaurant.
Yeah. I have to tell you this too, Justin. Yeah. You weren't listening to our show yesterday, but this is just incredible, and it's awful. And the fact that the black host would say, hey, we have a white racist over there, and we're going to accommodate him and ask, you know, that's going to be a problem for the 18 of you people of color. That is just so bizarre. I mean, I know we've got racism, and I know people run into it more than I do. I'm a white male, right? I don't know this world.
Yeah.
But just what you've described for us is so bizarre that yesterday on the show, I was trying to think of what else could have happened that would have explained this. And this was one of my thoughts, that maybe a customer seeing a basketball team come in of rowdy kids, why wouldn't they be, just said, you know what, I don't want to sit next to a noisy party. And it wasn't about the race. It was just about the fact that this was a noisy group. But all of that flies out the window if, before you even had your seat, they told you, we know this guy, he's racist, and we may have a problem here. And that's what happened, huh?
Yeah, so, and you know, you present a good question. Maybe it was just like nobody wanted to be around loud kids. But what I will tell you is that we had been out and about. Our kids had basketball games. We were at a birthday party before. So our kids, they were exhausted by the time they got there. They were just hungry. So, you know, they weren't being wild or crazy or anything. And again, this happened before we even sat there. Even if the kids happened to be a little bit loud, which this is a public restaurant. This is a family restaurant, so kids are going to be there anyway. So for one or two customers to dictate the environment or dictate who's around is ridiculous.
A couple of my texters have said this, if I may. John, maybe that host was trying to warn you guys or protect you guys. Are you angry at the host? Since you say he is a person of color, that just strikes me as a very strange interaction between the two of you.
No, I'm not angry at the host. In hindsight, he was trying to do the right thing. The problem is that Buffalo Wild Wings, that particular restaurant, I feel has trained him. When he first started working there, he wouldn't have asked that question to anybody. But my problem is that is not the first time that that's happened. And the reason being is just how the whole situation went. And when we get further into the story where the management wanted to accommodate
right.
and attempt to move us, it's not the first time that it's happened. So this young gentleman felt helpless. He was thinking, yeah. I'm going to try to protect these people, but yeah. I need to keep my job. I'm a young kid. I got to keep my job.
He lost his job. Did he get fired, that young man? Do you know?
I'm unaware. I do know that he was. From just public knowledge from the internet, from feedback, he was written up and sent home that day. So he was punished and held accountable for something that he was trained by that management team to accommodate. And I don't think that part was fair.
Justin Vowles on a phone line. He's the father of one of those basketball players. He's one of the adults, obviously, in the room for that Buffalo Wild Wings story that took place late last month in Naperville. Also on a phone line, Cannon Lambert Sr., the attorney representing the Vowles family. Cannon, how are we doing so far? Everything making sense on your end? Is there anything else you want to add to the conversation so far?
Well, the truth of the matter is that, to your point, none of this makes any sense. There are multiple layers to this whole situation and multiple assaults to multiple people in this situation. And so the biggest concern, frankly, that I have, and I think many of us have, including Justin, is that there's got to be a better environment. And there's got to be a better way to have. Look, we know that there are people out there that hold unfortunate views, and we can't legislate those views out of people.
Yeah.
But it's not something that can be okay that folks who go into a stream of commerce are put to this type of issue and then have to explain it to their kids.
Gentlemen, do we know who that individual is? Has he been made public in any way?
I would say this to that. I know that Buffalo Wild Wings has said that they are going to ban that person from their stores. Well, that's what they said, right? But in order for them to do it, they're going to have to notify all of their stores as to who that person is. Now, I know they've been reluctant to share that information publicly, so I'm not sure how they can take that posture where they say they're going to ban that person for life, but don't share who they're banning. I would invite Buffalo Wild Wings to be consistent. I think they should be consistent. But if they are consistent, it's going to be requiring of the fact that they disclose that information.
On the phone line, Cannon Lambert Sr., the attorney representing Justin Vowles. Justin's on the phone line, too. Gentlemen, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, then, Justin, you tell me the second part of the story, because you had two interactions with the management. Eventually, you left. This was page one on CNN.com yesterday and this morning. The whole country is paying attention to this bizarre story. And I've also got mixed signals from the press conference today about what action these families are going to be taking against Buffalo Wild Wings. We answer those questions next. Phone number is 312-981-7200. You can call or text. Lots of texts saying people identifying their race and where they live. And throughout the WGN radio listening area, people are appalled at this story. Some of you say you just can't believe it, and some of you say, oh, yes, we can. We'll talk to the mayor of Naperville after 2:30. We know that he has been hearing about this and has reached out. Buffalo Wild Wings' statement today includes this: we take this incident very seriously, and after conducting a thorough investigation, terminated the employees involved. I don't know if that includes the young man that first greeted them and warned them. Further, we have banned the customer who exhibited the inappropriate behavior from all Buffalo Wild Wings sports bars for life. We have been in direct communication with the families to offer our apologies for any unacceptable behavior. In addition, company-wide respect program we launched this fall, Buffalo Wild Wings will conduct sensitivity training throughout the Chicago area. We come back to our guests in 30 seconds. The Midwestern University Multispecialty Clinic in Downers Grove offers a comprehensive patient-centered healthcare experience at their dental institute, family medicine clinic, speech language institute, physical therapy institute, and their eye institute. These clinics, you get exceptional care from a team of highly qualified faculty and students. Learn more at MWUclinics.com or call 630-743-4500. 630-743-4500. The Midwestern University Clinic is your family's home for health care. Justin Vall, the father of one of the kids at that Buffalo Wild Wings, he himself was there. You've been hearing him tell the story. And Cannon Lambert Sr., the attorney representing the Vall family in Naperville, is on a phone line. Justin, we will move quickly here, but you all then, after that warning from the host, have your tables, and then what happens?
So we decided to take a seat, and we're sitting at the table. And after we're seated, a minute or two went by, and one of the managers came over to us, his name being John, came over to us where me and Marcus Riley, who's a good friend of mine, he had two kids there as well, and he's one of basketball coaches of the kids. The manager, John, came over and knelt down at the table and said, "We're going to have to move you. These tables are reserved." So we look at him and we say, no, John, we're not going to move. And Marcus tells him, "No, John, we're not going to move because of the color of our skin, and that these tables are not reserved." And just so you know, Buffalo Wild Wings has a no reservation policy.
Yeah, I've heard. Yeah. That's crazy. So what then eventually caused you all to leave?
So what eventually caused us to leave is that management couldn't rectify the situation. We overall, we were there for about 45 minutes to an hour. We had John, who's a manager, and then John's supervisor, Hannah, who is also a manager, came over and tried to talk to us as well. But after all of it, we felt disrespected.
All right, let me cut you off right there. Was there any conversation with them about moving the client? What about if this is about the proximity to the bigot, was there any conversation about moving that guy?
No, if anything, there was the opposite. John and Hannah, who were both the managers at the time, were very they were very surprisingly friendly with them. They actually, after speaking with us, they went over and sat at the table of the racist regular customer, quote unquote. They were sitting at the table having a conversation that had nothing to do with what was going on at the time. So their conversation with us was about having to move us, but their conversation with them was, they were talking about day-to-day stuff. And again, I don't know exactly what they're talking about.
All right, hold on,
but I can only assume.
I get you, man. Cannon, are you all, I know you want Buffalo Wild Wings to do as right by this now as they can going forward. But will there also be an effort to extract money from Buffalo Wild Wings?
So everything is on the table. I think that when people are assaulted, it is obvious that they need to do right. And I'm interested in finding out what they perceive to be doing right. What is it that they should be doing? They should be looking to make sure that when they employ people, they screen people to ensure that that they don't have biases that are going to flash in a situation like this. I want Justin, I want Marcus to be ambassadors to Buffalo Wild Wings, so that when they do this sensitivity training, there's a face. There's a practical and personal face to these sorts of things so that nobody can get away with abstracting these sorts of situations. I want to make sure that there's signage in employee break rooms that remind people of the importance of racial tolerance. Is there money that might come up of this? I mean, you know, unfortunately, that's how the legal system is set up. I'm hoping that we can do a lot more than just money, because this is going to demand a lot more before we can start to eradicate these problems.
I'm hopeful that we can do a lot more than just money. So you are going to sue them for monetary damages as well as trying to extract some corporate change, correct?
You don't have to sue people that you agree with. And I'm hopeful that Buffalo Wild Wings will agree that this is an egregious situation that should have never happened.
We are out of time, gentlemen. I really appreciate your time with us today. We're all just devastated that this has happened, and we'll continue to follow the story with each of you. Justin, my best to your team, your family, your son. Thanks for joining us. And Cannon, thanks for your time as well.
I appreciate you so much. Thank you.
Thank you, Justin. Appreciate you joining us.
Come back to Chicago.
To Chicago.
Chicago.
Drove to Chicago.
I'm ready to play, John.
You watch that Bears game this weekend, my friend?
I sure did.
And are you in counseling now? Or are you drinking? What are you doing?
Drinking right now.
Attaboy.
Shy City. Shy City.
I'm coming home again.
That's yesterday's show. All right, you can stop that now. That was yesterday's show. By the way, the news click at WGNradio.com, our daily web poll question, asked, what should the Bears do with Matt Nagy? 45% of you said, oh, keep him for now. The same way you sort of eat leftovers. Whatever. I didn't like it yesterday. I don't like it. I'll just eat it. You also had the option, fire him as soon as possible. 43% of you, the same number essentially, said that. Problem is, he's got a 5-year contract and you ain't paying it. Give him a raise, extend his contract, was 3%. You people were clearly drinking. And then the final answer was, I can't say what I think should happen on the radio. And that was 10%. Thanks again to Cannon Lambert Sr., the attorney representing the Vol family, and Justin Vol, the father of one of the basketball players at that Buffalo Wild Wings story. That thing is just amazing. And, you know, where I was playing the devil's advocate a little bit yesterday, I didn't especially like all of the words that came out of my mouth or the thoughts I was trying to express, but I was just somewhat incredulous that a host would come up to 18 African-Americans and say, you know, that's a racist over there. Literally use that word racist over there. And then they would all kind of cozy up to this guy at the bar as well. But when you listen to the TikTok of the story, as Justin told it, it sounds believable. And we haven't heard the end of it. When Cannon Lambert, the senior, was asked by us, well, so what is this lawsuit about? I get the feeling that if they don't get satisfaction, they will seek money. And I'm not sure what satisfaction is going to look like to them. But frankly, if Buffalo Wild Wings had to pay $14 million or $128,000 or whatever the number is, I would be 100% okay with that. That doesn't make them money grabbers. They didn't go in there looking for money. They went in there to lose money, to eat some chicken wings, and they couldn't get it done. If the only way you get a company's attention is suing them, then sue them and get some money. I have no problem with that. New topic. Christy Gutowski is in our studio, reporter for the Chicago Tribune. She wrote about the A.J. Friend story that perhaps you saw in Sunday's paper. Part two will appear this weekend in next Sunday's paper. And it was just a heartbreaking story for us all to follow. And her writing about it is comprehensive and so well done, which is almost beside the point. It's just an awful story. Christy, welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me, John.
I sure appreciate you joining us. Tell me about your decision to go back to this story and why now.
I've been a reporter in the Chicago area since the early 90s, and I don't know if you remember the case of Joseph Wallace. It was another prominent Illinois Department of Children and Family Services mess up where they just missed a lot of warning signs and the child unfortunately died of fatal abuse. And at the time, that case just really, you know, I said to myself, I want to do this with my life. I want to tell these children's stories.
And that story inspired you as a reporter, or were you a reporter at the time?
I was in college and,
getting
my master's and studying journalism, and I just never really forgot about him. And I've told DCFS stories like many reporters through the years, and unfortunately many tragic, you know, child deaths. But this one, more than 5,000 people estimated went to his memorial service, and an entire community came out for 6 days when his parents reported him missing, looking for him. And I just thought, you know, this case is resonating with people, and I wanted to, you know, dive into it and learn more who these people were and more about this little boy.
Do the headline for me on this. What happened?
It's really tragic and really dark, but luckily people seem to really care and want to know every little detail. So AJ was 5, lived in Crystal Lake. He was born around Halloween 2013 with heroin pumping through his veins. So DCFS took the child away from his parents and put him in protective custody.
Taken from his mother's arms and given morphine and then to protective custody.
Correct. He was in the ICU fighting for his life for a month. And then a cousin of the mother took him in and she wanted to adopt him. She didn't have children of her own and she kept him safe and helped him grow into a healthy little boy until 20 months.
And you write that he was developing sort of on cue, wasn't he? Despite his being born addicted, he seemed to be able to get weaned off the drugs and was hitting his milestones, right?
Correct. We were able to access some confidential records that really painted the picture of the first, you know, days, months, and years of his life. And he was, by all accounts, healthy, intelligent, inquisitive.
The mother, so she loses custody of the child, at least temporarily. Eventually, she regains custody. But she had already lost custody of another child, right?
She did. That was through a civil process, a private process. DCFS wasn't involved. Her own mother fought her to gain custody of the oldest child, who at the time was about 12. He's 19 now.
He's in college now, right?
He is. He's the silver lining of this whole story. He's doing great.
Yeah, you referenced him late in your story, and I thought, oh, yeah, right. How's he doing? He's in college. I was hopeful that there's a silver lining, as you say. Can you tell me anything about him, just as a quick aside here?
Sure. So he was much older than AJ, obviously. That's one of the things that bothers the grandmother in the stories. A lot of people think she left AJ and just took him, which is not the case. He was, he was born in July of 2000. So by the time AJ was born, he was already 13. And the grandmother had gotten him out of the house by then. And, there was visitations with AJ when he was born. But then there was a falling out with AJ's mom. So there wasn't much contact in the last 2 years. But, you know, she performed one miracle in saving the oldest son, but unfortunately couldn't save the younger grandchild.
Eventually, AJ is reunited with his mother and his father, who was an attorney but had lost his license. They were both addicts, right?
Correct. They were both addicts. And what's really interesting about the story is they began, their beginnings were so different than where they ended up. He was, voted most desired date his senior year at Crystal Lake High School, class of 77.
AJ Friend Sr., the father.
Right. He was the junior class homecoming prince, and he graduated with honors U of I and John Marshall, and he was really an up-and-coming star in the local community.
What was her backstory?
She had a good upbringing as well. She never knew her biological father. He had a lot of problems, and her mother divorced him when she was just 19 months old, but she had a regular suburban upbringing in northwest suburb, Schaumburg. Then the family moved to McHenry County. She got pregnant at 16 and dropped out, but she got her GED. She got a cosmetology license. She got married.
So there were no red flags that these are people who shouldn't get together, shouldn't stay together, shouldn't have a child. I mean, some of those circumstances aren't perfect, but Lord, plenty of people have gotten through that. They had a good shot at it, but they fell into some sort of addictive habits, right?
They did. When they met, he was actually 24 years her senior, and he was her divorce attorney. And by the time they met, they both already had addictions to opioids, painkillers. She complained. By that point, she was taking 12 to 15 painkillers a day just to get through the day. She complained of fibromyalgia symptoms. And he had some broken bones and car accidents and had been addicted to opioids as well. But together, they really spiraled into this to hardcore heroin, cocaine, domestic violence, things like that.
The sort of thing where a police officer or DCF worker will look inside and find animal feces on the floor, garbage strewn about, children not properly dressed. I mean, just obvious signs of abuse and decay of the family. What was DCF's interaction or role with the family in these early years?
It's another really interesting part of the story is everything seemed to go to operate properly in the beginning of AJ's life. There was a McHenry County child abuse and neglect juvenile case in which a judge overseeing it kept it open for more than 2 years, and the parents were required to do, you know, random drug drops, and DCFS had a caseworker going into the house twice a month, and there was aftercare, and there's AA meetings, and there was job requirements, and these parents really got their acts together for years, and then it all seemed to fall apart in about 2018.
In the online and, I guess, print versions of this story, we see pictures of the mother and the father at different stages in their lives and relationship with their child, and some of them, they look like the dregs, right? They look like heroin addicts.
Right.
And others, they look like a promising young lady and a handsome young man, and It's you know, there's so many layers to this tragedy, as you say. Obviously, foremost is the little boy, but it's also the tragedy of addiction, isn't it? Because you see sort of them devolve in the photographs, and I don't know how much sympathy I have for them, but you see how abused they were by their drug addictions, don't you?
You do, and it's important to note, though, that statistically drug addicts don't kill their children. You see neglectful situations like not getting them to school or not proper supervision, but this is an extreme outcome, and in the end, we don't have evidence that either of them were on heroin when he was killed, because she was pregnant and had blood tests. She was clean except for some prescription drugs.
Okay, so they have these interactions with neighbors who were trying to be helpful to no avail, the police on occasion, a contractor pointed out bad things. DCF has been in and out, but eventually they regained custody of AJ Friend. But they were also, at the end of his life, bad parents. There's the episode maybe that led to his death, where to punish him for soiling his pants, they give him a cold shower, right?
Correct. And from everything that I was able to find, I find that she was the one that had the most violent temper. And, you know, we were left to go, we weren't there. We're left to go on with what he said to the authorities afterwards. But he paints this picture of that she, you know, would do these harsh physical
AJ Friend Sr., the father.
Yes,
would.
Yeah, the father. And he really, you know, blames Joanne, his girlfriend, the mother of AJ. And he said, you know, he suggested to her that we start doing cold showers to discipline him instead of physical beatings.
Right. So that part of the story late in your writing, and in our studio right now, Christy Gutowski is the reporter at the Tribune, whose Sunday piece, it was Sunday, right, is about the story of AJ Friend, the little boy who was killed. The parents are in custody right now,
right,
correct?
Both charged with murder.
But that was really bizarre, too. Late in the story, the cold showers, a 20-minute freezing cold shower was his definition of a less severe punishment of the boy.
Yes, and I, you know, going back to the drug use, I'm not suggesting that I'm excusing what they did, but I just believe there's more here, and you know, maybe we'll learn about their psychological. I'm interested in learning more about this mother's mental health. I mean, you know, her youngest child described her as a monster. So I can't wait to learn more about what we see in court. But there is a video that has been disclosed from a month before he died. She had taken a cell phone video, 2 minutes, and then deleted it of her berating AJ. And he's got an ice pack on his eyes. And when he removes it, you just see the horrible condition he was in.
That video's been captured, though?
The authorities have it. The FBI was able to get it through subpoena of Apple from her phone.
Hmm. So something was going on late in this little boy's life. And in that span of time, she got pregnant again. Is that correct?
Correct.
That's troubling, too, isn't it? You can't control that. But my God, they shouldn't be having another kid.
They had two kids, actually, by the time that after AJ, but she had her last one, the little girl, May 31st. She was in custody for the murder of AJ.
So what's the status? I know we're covering vast spans of time here and not doing it justice that your many-page story does. Listen, if you do not already, today would be a good day to subscribe to a newspaper, because this sort of storytelling doesn't happen in sound bites on the radio or TV, and ain't nobody else doing this but trained professionals like they have at the Tribune, like we have here at GN Radio, but not always the luxury of time. Christy Gutowski's in our studio, so we'll just finish the telling of the story today this way. They're eventually caught, the parents, first denying it. What's their status? What's the timeline for their court case and so forth?
Sure. So they're both being held on $5 million bonds in the McHenry County Jail. Both have pleaded not guilty, and they appear in court on monthly status dates where there's, you know, exchange of discovery. There's been no, like, prominent court hearing yet in which, you know, a plea has been made or there's
been
testimony.
They have not pled guilty or not guilty? That hasn't happened?
No, just the arraignment where you plead not guilty, which is perfunctory. But, yeah, it hasn't, you know, he just died on 6 months ago. So I imagine the process will take a while.
773 texted in and said, "Your writing in this story was so compelling, I could not stop reading. Please keep up the good work, as painful as it is." Oh. I couldn't have said it better, 773. That's exactly what this is. I don't want to encourage you to read this story because it's great writing. It is, and I know it's a painful topic to pursue, but it's not gratuitous. You don't elaborate on any of the awfulness of it. You let the actions tell the story, and the deeds are amazing. So thank you for doing what you did on this, Christine.
Oh, thank you. And I hope it brings systemic change for the next AJ.
The next conversation. Let's visit again next week and follow up after you report again in the Tribune, all right?
Thanks, John.
Read it online. Christy Gutowski, the reporter at the Tribune, on the AJ Friend story. If you're Googling it, friend, of course, too many of us now know, is spelled F-R-E-U-N-D.
Thinking big thoughts. So you don't have to.
I got a
Here's John Williams.
Different way to say that. Instead of saying a high of 32, emphasizing the awfulness of it, Jen?
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it this way.
Okay.
A high of 32.
A high of 32.
Hey, well, that sounds a lot better. Wow, it's going to get up to 32. As opposed to a high of 30. A high of 32 sounds tragic, but a high of 32... We're at February, we'd be cheering that on.
Oh, yeah. In February, we'd be cheering that on. But, you know, everybody's got to go out and spend a little bit of extra money to buy all that salt early, it looks like.
Yeah, I was actually looking for a scarf today when I was walking out the door. Where's those damn scarves? It's only November 5th, for crying out loud.
See, I feel guilty wanting gloves. Like, I shouldn't want gloves. It's way too early.
Totally,
but the reality
the
is, I have a logical reason.
What's that?
That it's cold.
Right. I know that. But as soon as I do put on gloves, hat, and scarf, now I'm like, I'm owning the winterness that's awaiting me. And I don't want to do that.
I know. I haven't actually put them on yet, but my hands are already getting dry.
As I was walking to the station today from my L stop with my cold fingers, I thought, you idiot, you could have put on gloves. But no, you didn't want to wear gloves because you don't want to acknowledge that it's cold outside. As though that will make it not cold outside.
If I don't think about it, it's not real.
It's cold outside. Well, that's my thingies.
I don't know if you remember, but this is like scarring for my family. My husband fell just on ice out on the sidewalk last year and has a whole plate and seven screws in his leg because of it. So we're like, wait, no, just push this freezing temperatures back a little bit.
Two members of my family, one of them older, one of them not, slipped on the ice last year. It was bad at times last year. We were dropping like 10 pins.
Everybody was. Yeah. We had a few people here. Well, we had like a handful of people here that fell on the ice.
And then some of us were just fussy. So I watched Dancing with the Stars. We'll go on to the cross-country story and the IHSA here in just about 60 seconds. But I do want to just keep you abreast of what's been happening on Dancing with the Stars. Daisy and Brenda and I watch it at my house. The dizzy, dappled dachshund and Brenda sit front and center on the TV. And then I'm over in the corner, usually on my laptop, pretending like I've got more important things to do. But we like Dancing with the Stars because the costumes are pretty and the people are terrific. And I think it's a well-done show. Sean Spicer is still on Dancing with the Stars.
No way.
When he was announced as a member of the cast, I said, you watch, he's going to last much longer than his dancing merits. He's still on there. Literally now, there's only like six couples left, and they start with like, I don't know, 12 or something. So he should have gotten kicked off maybe the second week if it was just on dancing, but each week they go, who's saved? Sean Spicer is saved. And there's this sort of like, wow, how cool for him. Holy cow, this is wrecking the show sort of attitude. But now when they cut to the judges, so they have two final people there. Like they said, they have them all standing up there like a pageant, right? And they say, okay, Joe's been saved. Mary's been saved. Bob's been saved. And then they walk off and wave. They're saved. Then there's three of them left. And then they say, now it's down to two. And then when it's down to the final two that the audience has selected, then the judges decide one of them will be saved and one of them gets kicked off. When they cut to the judges and Sean Spicer is not there, the judges have literally their head in their hands. They're looking down going, oh, no, Spicer is back for another week. Can you believe it? But I told you people would vote for him.
Now, is he good?
He is as good as you can imagine, which is not nearly as good as these people. Like he's as likable as you can imagine. And he's owning the ridiculous costumes that he has to wear. He's doing everything you could ask of a Sean Spicer. But he's a terrible dancer. And what's happening now is people are just voting for him because he's Sean Spicer. The president tweeted, vote for Sean Spicer. Like, I don't know. You should vote for whoever the best dancer is, not who you're most sympathetic with. But that's the way the show goes.
That's how voting in general usually should be.
Now that you mention it.
Got a point.
So who got kicked off last night?
Who got kicked off last night?
Was it Kate Flannery?
Is she the red-haired lady?
Yeah.
Yes.
That sucks.
And she's delightful.
She's really good.
And she wasn't a bad dancer. Spicer gets bad scores. And then when they go to the review, they go, well, you were terrible and you're awful, but for awful, you were okay. And then they say, and then they have them all standing there and they say, who's the first couple saved? Sean and Marianne or whoever he's dancing with. And then they walk off. If I were Sean Spicer, I would start to feel bad about the fact that my continuing to be on the show is keeping other people who legitimately should be on the show from being on the show. Now, fortunately, no one gets cancer here, right? I mean, it's just a dancing show, so who cares? But if you're going to put on a dancing show, that's not what you have on TV right now. It's a different show. It's not a show about dancing. It's a show about Sean Spicer is what it is. 815 just texted in. You were exactly right on the Spicer thing. I don't like that. How did that text sneak in? Paul, you're on WGN Radio. What did you want to say? Hi.
John, I want to tell you this. I was just caught you right now, but this is exactly how Donald Trump got to be president. He's a reality president. He's not even a good dancer. It's just amazing the power of the American people and this trance that they get put into based on stardom or something. I can't quite tell. That scares me to death for 2020. I mean, if Sean Spicer is getting elected to Dancing with the Stars to be a top contender, what is going on with America?
Right. So you're worried that by extension, if Spicer can continue on the show, that bodes well for Donald Trump in 2020, right?
Absolutely. It just shows you how foolish it is. You know, because you're right. I mean, I've watched the show before. I think it's entertaining.
Oh, yeah.
It's enjoyable.
Yeah.
I get the same picture you do.
Yeah.
But there are good dancers. There shouldn't be bad dancers near the end of the show. You should be wowed. Forget about the costume.
Don't you think at some point Spicer should just throw up his hands and say, hey, thanks anyway, but no, I'm going to walk. I'm just going to concede defeat here. I get it. I know what's happening. No, thank you. Thank you, but
yes, exactly. I totally agree. Thank you for bringing it up. It's great listening to you.
I appreciate your phone call. I'll tell you what, the flip of that, though, is that if Sean Spicer continues on the Dancing with the Stars show, and you wonder, does that bode something for Donald Trump in 2020? The flip of that is the World Series Game 5, where the president got booed, and for that matter, the what was it, UFC? What was the fighting
match? It was like an MMA fight in New York, right?
Yeah, so Donald Trump was there with his two sons and then a few congressmen and a whole bunch of Secret Service guys and smart-looking fellas, and they went to watch that, and the crowd either cheered or booed. I've watched a lot of video of it. Fox News said Trump cheered and booed at the event. CNN said Trump booed and cheered at the event. You see the difference? And then the videos get posted, and some of them are clearly booing, and some of them are more cheering. I guess it just depends on who is holding the camera. But it was a mixed crowd, let's say that, for the president at that event. So where we're used to people just losing their minds cheering on Donald Trump at rallies, this wasn't a crowd pre-selected to like Donald Trump. It was more random. And in that case, it's not overwhelming the support for the president. And it's rare that you and I get that sort of crowd reaction to Donald Trump. Let's go to IHSA Sports now. There's a guy named Joe Trost who's been on with us for a few times as we have followed what was first the teachers' strike and then the students getting locked out of sports. And now this teacher strike is over in Chicago, but some of the kids still aren't going to be able to play. Joe Trost is the founder of the PepsiCo Soccer Showdown, and he was talking to us a lot, just because he understands this, about the IHSA kids and the CPU kids wanting to, let's see, Chicago Public CPS kids wanting to participate in the state tournament in soccer. So we asked him to come back and maybe explain to us a little bit what was going on here. Hi, Joe. How are you?
Good. How about yourself?
Pretty good. But I thought this thing was all settled. And now there's the story that the IHSA, it sounds like, itself is trying to keep the kids from running in the state cross-country meet. Is that correct?
That's correct. So to stay along the theme that you were just talking about, the dancing between CTU and CPS ended, and now you got the dancing with the IHSA and the court system. So last Friday, the kids won in court, and really so did the IHSA, when a judge ruled that they could take part in the sectionals. Basically, there was an emergency injunction stating that there was some harm if the kids wouldn't take part in the sectionals, and the judge agreed. Kids ran on Saturdays, throughout the region. There were 13 individual CPS runners that advanced, along with one team, Mather High School, to this weekend's state meet down in Peoria. And late Monday, the IHSA filed an appeal of the ruling, and they are asking the appellate court to overturn the emergency injunction. And with that, that could keep the 13 individual runners and one team out of the state meet this upcoming weekend.
Hold on right there. So I have we asked Craig Anderson, the executive director of the IHSA, to come on. He did with us when the teachers were on strike and sort of explained this to us. And he points out that the Honorable Neil Cohen, November 1st, allowed Chicago Public School runners to compete in the state series sectionals November 2nd. And as you've told us, some of those kids advanced. But now the IHSA itself, that you think would cheer on the fact that the kids get to participate in IHSA events, is trying to keep those students who qualified for the state tournament from participating in it. And he writes, because the court's order allowed the CPS participants to circumvent the IHSA rules, and we believe this ruling creates a dangerous precedent that hampers our ability to uphold rules that play out in the future. So if they had this rule that said you can't do it, the court said, oh, yes, you can, well, now it would all feel moot to you and me because the strike is over. I mean, you don't even need to fight this fight anymore, but the IHSA, as I understand it, is saying, no, we still want to fight it in principle, because if we let the courts overturn our rules, then what good are our rules? Do I understand that correctly, Joe?
That's correct. And, John, it's very important what I'm about to say. Don't let the truth get in the way of the facts. And the facts of the matter are that the IHSA cherry-picked all the way through the strike, deciding what bylaws they were going to pass and what ones they were going to enforce. Let's start with when they decided which appeals they were going to hear. They didn't hear the soccer appeal. They decided to hear a football appeal. They decided to go overrule a bylaw that kept Simeon out because they'd only played 8 games. They allowed them to get past that. They allowed girls volleyball for the city championship to be played tonight when the girls volleyball state series is going on. And when that's going on, per their bylaws, there's supposed to be no other games. At the end of the day, they made the right decision on Simeon. Everybody's happy that they're in the state playoffs. They made the right decision to allow the city championship girls volleyball game to take place. They are cherry-picking what they want to do. And what happened here is a judge told them that that's exactly what you're doing, and tired of seeing this go on, and you're harming these kids. It doesn't hurt you as an organization to allow the kids to run, and he allowed them to run. And yes, the IHSA is coming back just like they did in 1995, the other time that they lost in court to a team, to a school, which was Mount Carmel Wrestling. 2 days later, they canceled the state tournament. They have a hard time when the courts tell them what to do. And you have to realize that even though they may think that they're a member association and their bylaws work within their member associations, when you're dealing with public schools and public tax dollars, the courts do care how you impact the public. And that's something the IHSA has a hard time understanding when they're told what you can and can't do.
All right, well, we asked Craig Anderson to come on. That's not possible today. Maybe he'll want to join us and explain the other side to me, but I just don't see this as a battle worth winning. Let the kids run. Nobody wants to be on a cross-country team except for cross-country runners, right? But most people go, wow, that's a lot of work, and you don't even have a ball. So that's just looks like this sort of commitment and dedication most of us don't have. You're just going to run all day long, and eventually you're all going to line up and run one more time, and then you're done running. That doesn't sound like fun to a lot of people. And yet these kids do that, and then they get to the state tournament. They actually have qualified these kids, and for academic reasons, I don't mean reading, writing, arithmetic, I mean for legal reasons, the IHSA wants to keep them from the starting line. When I get to be king, those kids are running this weekend, let me tell you. We'll pause here. Joe, hold on for just a minute. Maybe you have an observation. 312-981-7200. Joe Trost is joining us, who's become our ad hoc IHSA soccer and other sports expert. And he has a journalism background, you can probably tell, as well as being the founder of the PepsiCo Soccer Showdown. So just before the break, Joe, I told you I'm just amazed that the IHSA is fighting against these kids. Do you know what, in fact, is going to happen at the state cross-country meet this weekend then?
You know, it's going to play out here. So the plaintiffs in the case, so the Jones parents, their legal team needs to file a response to the appeal. That'll be filed tomorrow afternoon, and then it's 5 days that the appellate court has to rule on this. They could do it before, which could impact the kids this weekend, or if it dragged out all the way to Monday, the kids would run this weekend. But then, let's say if they rule in favor of the IHSA could turn around and say, well, you know, if any of these teams, you know, finish in the top, you know, where they get a state trophy, or if any individual runners are in, you know, in the top where they're all state, they could say they're disqualified. So if you just think about it, you know, think if you're a 16 or 17-year-old kid. You've been working all summer, all fall for this. You've gone through the roller coasters of emotions of the strike. You get that excitement last Friday night. 12 hours later, you're out running. You earn this. And then on Monday, as you're starting to prepare mentally for the state meet, you know, you have adults in Bloomington who come in and possibly pull the rug out from under you. And that's really what people are saying. This is supposed to be a pro-kid association. And, yes, it's a very complex subject, but at the end of the day, they could have went through this, regathered back with their board and with their membership and said, hey, you know, this wasn't an ideal situation to be in. We're the third largest city in the country, you know, basically was wiped out of the state tournaments. How can we make this better for kids in the future? And they're basically going back to the courts.
Okay, well, we'll follow that story. I wonder how competitive the kids would be anyway because they've lost some time. I guess you can still be running and training, but I think there's something about being active versus inactive that affects your competitiveness, and I think handicaps the kids even that much more at the starting line, just what's happened the last couple of weeks anyway. Joe, I'm out of time today. We'll continue to extend our invitation to the IHSA to join us this week. And why don't you and I make a point of talking again in the near future, okay?
Great.
Thanks for your time, Joe.
Talk to you soon.
Joe Trost, founder of the PepsiCo Soccer Showdown and our ad hoc correspondent on that. Mayor of Naperville joins us in just a couple of seconds. Earlier, in fact, at the start of the show, we visited with Cannon Lambert Sr., the attorney representing the Vall family, the family from Naperville that was at the Buffalo Wild Wings, and were asked essentially to leave because there was a man the restaurant staff themselves identified as racist. This was a group of African Americans, a bunch of kids from a basketball team and some adults, and they were told to sit somewhere else. Eventually they left because the white racist did not want a black group of people near him. Justin Vall, the father of one of the basketball players who was also there, joined us and was compelling. Gave us the minute-by-minute story of what exactly happened in that restaurant. And the attorney then talked about what they think should happen next. If you haven't heard that conversation, listen to our podcast of this show. Just go to WGNradio.com on the John Williams page. You'll find that part of our show, the first half hour. We'll post that once we walk out of the studio here at 3 o'clock. And a lot of you are texting to us about that. You've also been texting to us about the conversation we just had with Joe Trost, and that was about the IHSA essentially trying to keep the kids from going to the state cross-country meet. And a couple of you have pointed out that the kids did qualify at the sectional to go to the state meet, but they didn't go to the regional preliminary to the sectional. So maybe they shouldn't have been able to compete at the sectionals anyway. They shouldn't be able to go on to the state tournament because they didn't qualify for the previous meet, the regionals. But the kid, that's no fault of the kids. they couldn't help it. The school was on strike, and they weren't allowed to compete at the regionals. So then they say, okay, you can skip that step. We're going to put you in the sectionals. Well, they don't get to the state meet, if I'm not mistaken, unless they do well at the sectionals anyway. So however those Chicago Public School kids got to the sectionals, they don't go on to state unless they do well enough, right? So I'm still of a mind to let them run in the state meet this weekend. What's the harm? It's cross country. It's not like we only have so much court space. I know the runners jockey for position, but 13 more runners is not going to harm anybody's chance of winning the state meet. And then a lot of you are still texting us about Dancing with the Stars. We'll pick that conversation up tomorrow, as well as the conversation that a lot of us have been having lately about the expression OK Boomer, which now appears to be so much more than just a one-off, than just a silly expression. But let's go back to the story in Naperville. The mayor is on the phone line. Steve, this is John Williams, and you're on WGN Radio. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm doing well, John. Yourself?
Good. I appreciate you taking our call. Is it Chirico?
Chirico.
Pardon me, Chirico. The mayor of Naperville. How long have you been the mayor there, Steve?
5 years now.
Okay, so what's that mean? You've won two elections? Is that how that goes?
That is correct.
What do you do for a living when you're not mayor? What's your background?
Well, I'm a business owner originally, but since I've been mayor, full-time mayor.
And did you grow up in the area? What's your story around the town of Naperville itself?
Yeah, I've been here my whole life since our family moved here in 1960. Huh. And so I'm a... I'm a product of the District 203 school system, and have raised my family here, watching my grandkids grow up here. So, proud member of the community.
You know why I called you, but just tell me a little bit more about you. What made you decide to run for mayor of that town?
I've been pretty blessed. As I said, I grew up here, and this community has given me a lot, and I just felt like my skill set at this time in Naperville's history would be a good fit for some of the things that Naperville as a city was going through, just financial stewardship and things like that, and being able to apply some of those skills to our challenges here as a community, and I think it's served the community well.
What was your first reaction when you heard this Buffalo Wild Wings story, Mr. Mayor?
Probably anger. It was saddening and disheartening in many ways, but not necessarily surprising, understanding that this type of thing does occur, unfortunately, throughout our country. But so I wasn't shocked or surprised, just more of, again, I think just anger that this kind of stuff still goes on.
Yeah. Well, I think we all had that reaction, but I'm interested that you say you weren't surprised. Is that a commentary on Naperville per se or America in general?
America in general, for sure. I feel like Naperville is a very welcoming place, but you hear about these things across our country far too often, and so it's not surprising. I mean, we'd be naive to think that any community is without these types of individuals who have these views. But it's not surprising or shocking to me, but it's still saddens me.
Somebody texted me yesterday that the racial composition of Naperville, I know it's predominantly white. They said 95%. I didn't double-check that. Do you know what the racial composition is of Naperville?
It's about 31% non-white, much of which is Asian-American, primarily in that subgroup would be Indian-American. About 21%, I believe, would be in that category. So the diversity in Naperville has changed significantly over the past 20 years, for sure, and it's something we're very proud of.
So you were disappointed when you heard this story, saddened, maybe not shocked, I get your point, but angry, if nothing else. What did you do about it? What is going to happen from the city's perspective?
Well, a couple of things. The first thing I did is I reached out to the people who I could contact, the Vowels. I spoke to Justin, and I was back and forth through text message with Mary, and just offered my apologies that they had this experience in our community, and assured them that that's not the type of community we are, and offered to meet with them personally and to meet with the kids, especially if nothing else, to help them celebrate what they had achieved, and just make them know that we cared, and that if there was anything we can do as a community to please reach out. And so that was first. And I think second, then, just make a public statement that this, these types of things are not acceptable, not anywhere, and certainly not here. And so, you know, we did that. Since that time, today actually, at the request of the Buffalo Wild Wings executive, you know, leadership team, we met with the president. I met with the president and a number of his staff here at City Hall to discuss what had happened and what's being done. And just to make sure that, you know, from our perspective, you know, we want everybody to feel safe in this community, and that includes the workers, employees of businesses. And so that, you know, when people come here, whether they're guests or residents or, again, employees, that they're in a safe environment. And I wanted to make sure that they are taking the necessary steps to make sure that they have a safe environment.
Did you have that face-to-face meeting yet with the Vall family?
I have not.
Are they amenable to that? Justin didn't mention that to us, nor did I ask, but I'm just wondering if that, in fact, is going to happen.
I would love for it to happen, and I offered it, you know, offered it to them. I'm just sort of waiting to hear back. I knew that they were sort of, I think they're sort of in a state of, you know, this has been a lot coming at them very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'll reach back out at some point here when the dust settles. But at this point, I sort of left the ball in their court and just said, if there's anything we can do, let me know. And I certainly would like to meet with you, the other families, or and especially the children.
We wanted to talk to Buffalo Wild Wings, too, at a corporate level, but they just gave us a two-paragraph statement that everybody has.
Right.
You said you met with the president locally or the national corporate president?
The corporate president flew in from Atlanta this morning. And
he's in town. He's in town, right? He was in town today?
He was, at 10:30 this morning. He was here at City Hall.
I see. So, according to their statement, they say that they already had a company-wide respect program in place, and that they're going to do sensitivity training throughout their sports bars in the Chicago area in response to this incident. Was there anything else that they said or he said that you can relate to us?
Well, a couple of things I think that are takeaways for me from that meeting. The first and foremost is that through their investigation, they verified the accounts that we've read about and what was posted on social media to be consistent with their findings. And so I think that that's important to establish. Second, and then that was a number of people who were present, other employees and that were present and camera footage and things like that, that, you know, during their investigation that led them to that conclusion that this was, the accounts were very consistent with what they found.
Yeah.
They apologized. They did talk to us about that respect program. They said it was being rolled out. It is not, you know, they still said that they're in the distribution of posters and things like that that have been distributed to many, but not all of the locations, talking about what the respect program means and some of the things that in the program are anonymous hotlines in case people feel like they're in an environment that's unsafe or there's harassment or any types of things that happen in the workplace. Or if a customer or another employee is making someone feel uncomfortable. So it gives them a communication device that allows people to do it in a way that they feel is safe. So that's what they're doing. But my understanding is that program has not been implemented yet. It's in the process of being rolled out, and that they said they are at this time contacting the third party consultants who have put that together and asked them to implement into that existing program sensitivity training.
As the mayor of Naperville, does it trouble you the message this sends out to the rest of the country about your town?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, that's, look, this was a very painful experience for these families. And first and foremost, we need to think about them, right? And that is more important than, you know, the reputation that or what people might feel about our community. It's more important that we think about them first. And so that's what's really been on my mind. These things happen. Look, every town it happens, and you are embarrassed by it sometimes, depending upon the situation, and sometimes angered, as in this situation. But, you know, we're a big city. We have 150,000 people here, and we have guests. We have hundreds of thousands of guests here that visit us each year, and so you're going to have these types of things occur, and we just have to manage them as best we can.
Yeah. All right, Mr. Mayor, I appreciate you coming on with us. I'm glad you took the time to do so. I think that's necessary. I don't know how this issue resolves itself, but I think conversations like this are just the beginning, and I'm glad that you're willing to have that with us here. Any last message or thought you have before I let you go?
No, thanks for having me today, and I wish it would be under different circumstances, but we'll continue to work with this.
Naperville has a reputation, and deservedly so, as being a safe town, being a successful town, being a productive town. Incomes are high, property values are good. There's, you know, a lot of the metrics that you would use to measure a great place to live, Naperville does very well in. And I think the only asterisk by that will be, well, what's the racial composition? How friendly is the town? Is it a welcoming community? Is that a barrier to other families or to anybody that's there? And I think that's now the question mark that some people have just because of this story. And I'm sure you will tell me that you all don't deserve that. Some people texted me yesterday and said, I'm not surprised to hear this. But that's, I think, just sort of the universe that you're living in and governing in right now, right?
Yeah, a big part of that is that we have, it's a very divided country right now. So you certainly hear a lot of rhetoric around everything that happens. And Naperville, in some regards, we're very, very different in the last 20 years than we were prior. Prior to 2000, it was fair to say that Naperville is predominantly Caucasian. There's no question about it. And so the reputation as being that was probably accurate. But in the last 20 years, there's been significant change in our demographics. And as I said earlier, we like that. It's been a great part of our community, and culturally, it has made us richer. And so we embrace it. And so it's a changing community, and people can judge if they want, but we're very proud of what we've built here and who we are.
Yeah, well put, Steve. I appreciate your time today. Let's visit again, as you said, under better circumstances. My best to all of you out there.
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate your time. Mayor Steve Chirico from Naperville. And before we visited with Joe and the mayor of Naperville, we also talked a little bit about Dancing with the Stars, which we watch at my house. I just think it's a terrific show. And they always do this, at least they do this, more now than they used to. They'll put somebody on there that you go, oh my God, really, Jerry Springer, or somebody like that. And sometimes it's a person of a certain political persuasion that's hot in the news. Sarah Palin's daughter was on the show, for instance, not that she was a politician, but some people that you found out through politics, which is a very dangerous place to go when you're just trying to enjoy a dancing show. So Sean Spicer is on it. And the longer the show goes on and Sean keeps surviving, the more grueling this exercise becomes, because it's less now about the dancing and more just about people cheering on Sean Spicer, which you can do all you want, but it's not fair to the other dancers. And if you don't like watching Sean Spicer dance, then the only harm is to a television show, right? There's nothing real serious here. But if it's your show and you enjoy watching it, for instance, if it's your show and you produce it, you want to, I think, do the best version of your show that you can. And clearly now they're not doing it, because it's not about the dancing. It's about people voting for somebody that a lot of people don't like. A couple of you have pointed out this. John Bobby Bones, who won last year, so this whole thing's a joke. Next text. John, do you not remember who won last season? It's why I stopped needing to watch. They need to depend more on the judges. That's why I like the World of Dance. 312. I quit watching last week. John, he's having fun doing it. It was funny how they said, we keep kicking you off the boat, and they keep pulling you back in, that being the viewers of the show. John, same deal on Dancing with the Stars for Ross, who was horrible. And John, you're an anti-Spicerette. I didn't know that was a thing, but maybe I am. John, Dancing with the Stars rules need to change. Some votes are a reaction to constant Trump bashing among almost all TV, in my opinion. Thanks for your show. Hey, thanks for listening to my podcast. This is John Williams. I'm live weekdays from 1 to 3. And remember, our Mincing Rascals podcast drops Thursdays at 5. The Rascals is a round table of talkers and journalists. This year, judged best in the state by the Illinois Broadcasters Association.